Okay.
Anjali, welcome to the show. This is very exciting for me. Can you introduce yourself? And before you do that, I had never seen the cover of your book. Okay. Oh. Because the PDF that I got didn't have a cover. So that cover is amazing.
I'm so glad you like it, and we definitely need to talk about it. I mean, honestly, we could spend an entire hour talking about that image. It is wild. Hi, I'm so happy to be here. I'm smiling like huge, and you can't see me, but I'll try to introduce myself through like giddiness. I'm Anjali Reza Kolb, and I wrote a book called Epidemic Empire, and I am a huge fan of your podcast and writing in general and Twitter presence, and this is just a delight. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for this book. I loved it. As I was saying, it's kind of, you and I have we have strange coincidences, intellectual coincidences. I mean, they're not that strange because this is what institutions are for, right? This is their job, is to produce people who have like, who take up similar projects. Yeah, accidentally so. So like, I'm curious about a lot of different things, but it's not an easy book to summarize.
Thank you. That's nice.
I mean that's a good thing and a bad thing too, right? Because with academics, people who don't know, like you need, like, that's just true for a lot of different things, but you need to have like a tight pitch, because like it has to, everything, you know, neoliberal hellscape we live in, everything has to be like, you know, nutritionally balanced and very, very calorically light. So like it has to be tight, but like this book kind of, it jumps around a lot temporally. It has a pretty broad reach, and it moves between a lot of different kinds of text. The first chunk is rooted in 19th century studies and like sort of canonical literature, and then it moves to Algeria, and it closes with, I mean, among other things, and it closes with a study of like the 9/11 report. So like, can you walk us through the argument? Like, I'm going to press mute and just kind of riff a little bit, because you'll obviously do a much better job summarizing it.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm happy to. To the point of like the tight little elevator pitch, I mean, this is such a painful experience, like at the end of graduate school when you're like deep in your archive and you're swimming around and I think it was literally in an elevator at an MLA. I was like, had gone for an early morning swim, and I was like going, you know, to rocky myself up for interviews or whatever. And I was going back up to my hotel room to like shower and get ready. And it occurred to me that like the tight little elevator pitch for this book is that it is a deep dive into a shallow metaphor. And the shallow metaphor is a terrorism epidemic. And that language was used so pervasively in the months, weeks, even hours after 9/11. I write about this in the beginning of the book, but it really, like, from the top of the stairs in the undergraduate teaching building where I was in class when the second tower went down to the bottom of the staircase, I had already heard like three different people say that it was that Islamism was a cancer, or this was a terrorism virus, or terrorism was some kind of epidemic. And that just like burgeoned in the public discourse over the next couple of years. And, you know, meanwhile, I was like studiously learning the work of postcolonial criticism. So that's like the genesis of the book. It's like, what is this figure? What does it mean? What is its history? Why is it so easy to reach for? What if we defamiliarize it enough that it becomes a figure again, and not just a kind of flat, dead turn of phrase? And so the argument of the book is basically that confluence, or that coming together, emerged from a set of conditions in the British Empire in the 19th century that was sort of a coincidence and sort of not. That set of conditions was the first outbreaks of cholera starting in 1817 and the Indian Mutiny of 1857. Now, that sounds like a really big gap in time. So to give you like the super concise version, and then we can dig into any part of it that's like more or less interesting to you. I was like, okay, so there's this historical coincidence in the 19th century, and it's like has everything to do with how empire was created, like the threat of bodies moving around within the British Empire and the threat of insurgency against the Raj, which was only installed in 1858 after the uprising, or the mutiny, as I still like to call it. And once that tethering happened in that moment that I would call like the modern imperial tethering of disease and insurrection, it kept coming back over and over again in periods of decolonization. So one of the things that you see that's sort of oddball about the architecture of the book, and this is what you were kind of gesturing at earlier, is that it jumps around in time because decolonization movements didn't happen all at the same time. There was a kind of emergence phenomenon, right, where there would be like generations of activists, generations of insurrectionists and rebels, and it would take time for those movements to build and to sort of explode into the public sphere. So I was really thinking about the late 19th century Indian uprisings, and then the next moment at which Islam and disease came together as a way of describing insurgency was in Algeria. So I kind of like put these scenes together and then started building textual bridges between them to see like, what are the details that link these periods? It's not just like, oh, we're talking about disease and oh, we're talking about anti-colonial uprising. But there were other kind of factors like the persistence of the memory of disease. So cholera comes back in Camus' The Plague in really interesting ways. And then finally, the contemporary moment. And when I talk about the contemporary moment, as you pointed out earlier, it sort of ends in the 9/11 Commission report and the Senate Intelligence Committee report on torture, which is the chronologically last text that I read in the book. But my contemporary moment, so to speak, stretches back to the 1980s. So basically post-Iran hostage crisis and the kind of South Asian diaspora in Thatcher era Britain, and then the sort of fall of the British Empire in Thatcher era Britain, and then the rise of the American Empire during that period. So the book takes these three scenes as sort of exemplary in telling the story of approximately a century. Disease historians call this the cholera century, so 1817 to 2017, basically, the cholera centuries. But I think it's also the defining period for metaphorizations of political violence as natural phenomena. So I wanted to bracket the book in those two ways. And literature forms the backbone of my readings, both because it's my training, but also because I was really interested in how literature, like big, big novels, novels that sell a lot, that get translated a lot, how they impact medical and political discourses. So I talk about this a tiny bit in the book, but I really follow the critic Jed Esty, who's like interested in famous novels. Not that unfamous novels are unimportant, but I look at Kim, Dracula, Camus' novel, The Plague, and a bunch of Salman Rushdie books, but especially The Satanic Verses, because they really like exceeded the realm of the literary. And they provide like such great rafts for sort of floating through the waters of discourse to get to a place like the 9/11 Commission report or like early medical writings on epidemics and cholera, which we don't think of as literary, but have so many literary artifacts in them and around them and are built on literary blueprints. Let me stop there so we can talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, no, that's really good. I wanted to kind of slow it down a little bit because if for some it might be a little tricky to parse because the language of like epidemiology, right? The discipline of epidemiology, like a lot of it seems to us like highly naturalized, but these disciplines are, at least in the sense that like, oh, these are things that exist and these are sort of scientific words overlaid onto them. However, like we don't really think of these disciplines that are like, you know, so profitable and so important to capitalism today as like historically created, right? So like part of what you do in the opening bits is kind of like tell the story of epidemiology and like the study of diseases and like the idea. And so like, that's why the cholera stuff is there, obviously. But like, then the metaphor, however, of how that is overlaid onto the history of Orientalism. And like this kind of results in what we kind of still circulate in the word of Islam, right? Like that was kind of my first question for you, which is like the word Islam is like, I always think of it as kind of silly word in terms of like whenever it's turned into anything but the name of like a global religion, right? Like if you want to just reference the global religion of Islam, like fine. It's like calling the continent of Africa, like, okay, that's the African continent. I mean, we can talk about what continents are and like, you know, the world island, Mackinder, blah, blah, blah. But like the idea of like a geographic continent, there's like a literal thing there if you want to like believe that. But the idea of Islam, however, right? Like we don't say Christendom seriously.
Like the Muslim world, yeah.
Like we don't say that. Like cause
wait, maybe we should.
Maybe we should. But like we have more nuance coded into our brain than saying that. And so I love that first little bit, how you like put quotes around Islam. I was like, thank you. Finally, someone does this. Like this word doesn't exist. Like this concept doesn't exist. Like this exists primarily in the minds of like the Occident, right? Like in the kind of Occidental imagination. Anyways, that wasn't really a question. That was kind of like my first initial question. Which was that. But I do wanted to sort of ask you to go over the argument again in terms of like just simplify it, because it is a tricky thing to follow, because you are combining like essentially like the study of like the critique of Orientalism made famous by Edward Said with the like sort of very complicated evolution in medical science and like the fields of medical science, and you do kind of fuse them into the as a kind of argument.
Yeah, so this is an amazing question and a tightening one. So I'll say like the thing that the spot in the archive that really just blew my mind was really around the difference between cholera, or like the second wave of cholera and the third wave of cholera in India. The first one of them was largely understood by what were starting to be called epidemiologists, although they were really just like gentlemen, like colonialists, right? I mean, these like naturalists or like men of science, like they weren't necessarily doctors. They were sort of surveyors or census takers or whatever. But they were like, the first one, they were like Hindus. Hindus are going too many places. And they're drinking water and they're pilgrimaging around, and then they're going back to their villages and everybody's getting sick. I mean, we heard this at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. It was like Lunar New Year causing a catastrophe. Workers are going from place to place and they're bringing their diseases with them. The third wave, so that was 1832, the third wave of cholera that came around the early 1850s was like, oh shoot, now it's Muslims going on Hajj. So cholera was endemic to the Indian subcontinent, and it actually exceeded its little like homeland around the Bay of Bengal because of deforestation by the East India Company in 1817. So you have that first thing, which is deforestation by a colonial power. So like straight up colonial resource extraction, ecological catastrophe causing the first epidemic. And then 1832, you have the colonial officials citing Hindu pilgrimage as the cause of this spreading. And then 1850s, you have colonial officials citing Muslim Hajj as the cause of the spreading outside of the Indian subcontinent. So like, these people were not interested in religion. They weren't interested in like what anybody's theology was. They weren't interested in what anybody's daily practice or belief system was. What they were interested in was diagnosing religion as an epidemic factor, right? And that kind of the building of that archive, which is quite deep and quite repetitive, really, really shaped the response to the 1857 mutiny. It's like it was the worst thing that British colonial officials could imagine, was all these Muslims going all around from South Asia to the Middle East. And it was in fact British companies that were taking them there. So John Slate, who's a historian, has an amazing book about the history of the Hajj. And a lot of this I learned from him, but like Thomas Cook, that hilarious, like which we remember from like cashing traveler's checks when we traveled when we were teenagers and so forth. Thomas Cook was running like a Hajj cruise ship from India to
get out.
Yeah. Isn't that incredible? And those ships were full of cholera and they were full of cholera because British, like East India Company, like a private company's troops had been cutting down trees for wood. So like, you know, 20 years earlier, 30 years earlier. So that story, just like really those decades, you know, leading up to the mutiny really shaped the discourse around what insurgency looked like and felt like, and it also had an actual material impact on the health of British troops to deal with the insurrection, to deal with the mutiny. People were just sick, like straight up had cholera and like couldn't move and couldn't fight or whatever. So that history is like, I think just, it really helped me see how a metaphor kind of comes to be a common sense. That reaching for explanations in this period of colonial meaning making and taxonomy produced categories, and religion was attached to certain kinds of pathologized behavior. And then it made it much easier during the uprising to say Muslim fanatics were running through the crowds with their swords drawn. So like all these mutiny novels that were published after 1857, these huge Victorian triple-decker novels, use this language of fanaticism to describe both the raging cholera and the raging Muslims. So I'm not sure if that totally gets to the question that you were asking. I mean, that's really like the kind of historical nexus that defines the problem in the first part of the book. And then similar things happen in the Algerian context, partly because of the movement of French troops around North Africa.
I don't know if you say this directly, but I think at a certain point I realized that like kind of what your book was kind of helped me realize is that like they can't imagine people fighting them for rational reasons.
Correct.
Right. Yeah. But like they think that like the fiction of Orientalism is that we're doing like part one of the fictions at least, is that like, oh, we're doing this for like the betterment of the world, the betterment of ourselves. Like that's like kind of one of the lies that like go with part of it. Of like going to educate, whatever, like, and their that belief though is that of the people who dare to reject that this offer, there must be something wrong with them, and they must have some kind of disease, and that disease can spread. So I was like, oh yeah, that's yeah, like she's right, like this is how, and that's why like the language of contagion easily translates so powerfully into like all of the disciplines. So like all these learned dudes on TV. Like growing up, we watched them. I mean, that's the other thing. The background of all this is 9/11, at least personally for you, because I mean, for us, because we grew up at this insane time where this, you know, historically sort of important attack, like coordinated attack by like a insurgent group based in West Asia, like has became like a nexus for like analyzing like world history. Like, isn't that, and which is funny now. I mean, not funny, but part of it is that like, more people die in one day thanks to Corona than they ever did 9/11. Like it's more than that. And it's been like that for weeks. So like if calamity scale of historical calamity is just like measured in terms of numbers, which kind of like the fiction, one of the things of 9/11 put that in our heads is like, oh, this was the biggest attack, bigger than Pearl Harbor, like because of like body count or something, like these kind of abstractions, like, but like the fact that like 9/11 is happening every day in terms of this body count, but there's no external enemy to turn that contagion onto. I mean, they tried with Wuhan and stuff to say who's the source, but you can't be racist against COVID. Like, it doesn't work.
Well, I mean, this is a fascinating, it's really interesting, I think in general, we're a little bit more sensitive to like visual racial stereotypes in 2020 than in 1882, which is when the image that's on the cover of the book is from, but not very much more. Like, you're right, they really tried. It's unbelievable how in a way, a virus is a thing that we can blame that, you know, oh God, is like to some
it could
extent,
be mobilized for racism.
Yeah,
but the actual, like fathoming the virus itself, you can't be racist against the virus. Like it's just right. It's this abstraction. It's something you can't, like you can find other things. And it's also too, like we live in the age of virality in terms of social media. Like viralness is good in one register in the sense of like the intention economy we live in. Like, oh wow, you went viral with your dumb tweet about like, about shopping. And it's like, you know, like that idea of virality is that something you can't stop. Right? Like that's something that is transmitted from people to people. So like we need that kind of infrastructure, the kind of imaginative infrastructure that epidemiology has created in us of like the image of a virus.
Yeah, but even that virality that you're talking about, like the things going by. I've actually like sort of demurred talking about this for years and years because people often ask me about the kind of internet analog of the metaphor of virality. I feel like I maybe have something to say about it finally, which is that like it does imply that the thing takes on a life of its own. Do you know what I mean? To go back to your point about how insurrection was coded, or like how insurrectionists or rebels were basically understood to be beyond logic, like they couldn't possibly be making this decision themselves. This is like where the genesis of the argument in some ways is in Guha's The Prose of Counterinsurgency. Like the Indian colonial record was obsessed with making every uprising sound like an earthquake or a tidal wave or a forest fire, right? It couldn't possibly be the agency of the people and an actual political demand. So this naturalizing habit was also completely depoliticizing. I think with things going viral on the internet, like one thing I can say about it is that it similarly suggests that you kind of can't make it happen, right? It's in a way like in the hands of the social. And I think this is why the virus is like such a great figure for shit we don't understand. Cause it's like, oh, I don't know who did it or how they did it. It just like went, it like took on a life of its own.
Yeah. Like it's one of those instances where like the metaphor of individuality and like individual consciousness and like, you know, agency in a sense gets translated onto the natural. And so that's what we call like a virus. Like a virus is like literally a living thing, right? Like, am I wrong? How's my
science? It's actually not quite alive. Like bacteria are understood to be actually alive. Viruses are like on a line, but yeah.
Oh, I thought it was the other way around, but that makes more sense because bacteria is like bread, like yeast, like that's like a living thing. But it's, a virus, virus is something that like reproduces, which is not the same thing as something that's alive.
Yeah, it like reprograms our DNA, which is different than having like anaerobic respiration or aerobic respiration. I think this is like, I did not make it very far.
You know what the real virus is? It's imperialism. the real virus are the friends we made along the way. wait, I have a question. I have a pause question. So why do you say mutiny? Because this goes against the grain. Right? You're supposed to say rebellion now?
It does go against the grain in some ways. I mean, I think I'm just a kind of pro-mutiny person, like in general. I've been, you know, I think there have been some amazing conversations happening over the last week about the terminology that we're using to describe what happened at the Capitol. I mean, I think a lot of sort of well-meaning white people were like, why aren't you calling them terrorists? And like a lot of people who study terrorism were like, no, we're retiring that term totally. Like, you know, let's not just like broaden the horizon of who's allowed to be called a terrorist. Insurrection, rioters, like I think, you know, my anarchist friends and my lefty friends and my like basically like pro, let's say just disruption on all levels of the, or like all spaces on that spectrum, have different feelings about this. I think with the mutiny, I feel proud, of that word. Like I feel like it's a labor action. And that, I don't know, this might be my like weird.
No, I agree. I think mutiny is a cool word. Pirates are cool in my book. Like yeah, pirates totally. Are
like fuck a captain.
Yeah.
And fuck a boat owner.
I'm like, yeah, I supported the Somalis in that Tom Cruise movie. Like, I knew where my loyalties were.
I'm like, sure I would have if I had seen it.
Oh, no, yeah. I mean, he's like the best. He's also the best part of that movie. That's why he's the meme. I forget his name. I know he's named Badger in Blade Runner 2049. Okay,
oh,
wait.
Perfect.
So I think Badger. Yeah, Mr. Badger something. Okay. Wait, so keep going.
Right. So just on the subject of mutiny, it's like boat space. I mean, I think a lot about the like the heterotopic space of the boat, which like exists in, first of all, in its own legal like sphere, right? I mean, maritime law is like separate. You're already in a state of exception on a boat. But I also like that it's this kind of, it's language that comes from, I think, the disruption of an aqueous trade network that was like instantiated by the Dutch, but then like really perfected by the British. So I like mutiny for that reason. I'm like, if you ran your goddamn empire on these boats of triangular trade, hell yeah, I'm there for a mutiny.
Yeah, I just think that I don't know. I don't know this stuff. You obviously know this stuff way better than I do, but like from the impression that I get, that it's like the word mutiny is a word that reflects the perspective of the imperialists insofar as like it's a word that the imperialists have for them. So let's reclaim it, which is an understandable impulse, totally understandable, especially given what the mutiny, and maybe this could be the next thing we talk about, is that how the mutiny became a cipher for rallying imperial kind of truth, like the rallying cry for a harsher, like more brutal imperialism.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating, like calling it a mutiny also suggested, I mean, I just want to say like very briefly on the question of like reclaiming, I love that life. Like, I don't know. I mean, I'm like a dyke who says dyke and a queer who says queer and like a packy who says packy in certain kinds of company. I think that there is power in that, particularly when you are living your life professionally and oftentimes socially in the colonizer's language. So I think that's like worth saying sort of explicitly. But to the question, I mean, I think that we forget often, or like I found myself forgetting often when I was studying this archive, or like when I was an undergrad or an early graduate school, that like there wasn't an official empire, like there wasn't an official colony in India until 1858. So what we had actually was much more like the corporate imperialism that we all like are oppressed by and live under today, where basically private companies own everything. So prior to 1858, it was literally this chartered company, the East India Company, with a militia, like not an army, but these troops, an armed force that was defending the property of this company that was off, you know, grabbing shit and bringing it back to the metropole for processing and then reselling back to the colony. So once the Raj, the official British government, was established in India in 1858, like it was less than 100 years until 1947. Like that period of formal colonial rule was pretty short, actually. And it was kind of the exception to a broader history of corporate neo-imperialism or para-imperialism or just imperialism is what I call it. The thing about what the mutiny did and how it was like mythologized, man, I mean, I think it had to do with a lot of different factors, including the kind of shift from the shift into Victoria's rule. But I think part of it was connected to that language. Like the mutiny implies that there was a proper sovereign and that it wasn't the leaders of the princely states who had kind of nominal sovereignty over their regions in India up until 1858. Mutiny as a term insists, right, on the part of the British government that there could be a proper sovereign of this entire territory and that that proper sovereign had been challenged. And now retroactively, we're going to install that proper sovereign, Victoria, the Empress of India. So I think in a way, maybe that's why the language is important to me, because it really shifted the political conversation from a kind of loosely federated territory of capitalist exploitation to a government that was centralized and had a figural and symbolic, but also operative head, figurehead, Victoria the Lady, the Queen.
Right, and the idea, but there's the same problem though, which is the how we measure these things, like how we imagine these things, how we periodize, and this is a problem for a lot of fields. But the relationship to England, to the British, is so powerful, or at least so overwhelming. There, not overwhelming is the wrong word, but like, how do you write? Like, how can you imagine Indian history outside, or like South Asian history, like in terms that aren't necessarily the imperialist terms, that aren't like, so like, I agree with what you're, I mean, I don't know. I don't have a stake in this stuff. Like, I don't know this stuff well enough to like really have an opinion, but I agree implicitly with your sentiments. So yeah, let's use their term for it. Sure. Because it marked a period of evolution, it marked a distinct shift, right? Like, like academics like things like lines that separate other things. So like, totally. That's a nice clean one. That's one you can't debate. After that one, there was big difference than before, right? But also your other great point, which is like, what, like, this is the problem I think with fascism as a term, right? Is that like, oh, fascism, the thing that Germany did against its own people versus what all the imperialists did to everybody else in the world, like much earlier, right? And so like that idea that, oh, fascism is something is when Europe does something bad to itself versus when it does something to other things. Otherwise, it's called imperial, like, you know what I mean? Whereas,
or genocide.
Like, the relationship, yeah, or genocide, like, right? Like, that's, like, that idea of, that it's it kind of betrays, like, a poor understanding of what governmentality is, what, like, states do, what, like, you know, political violence is, what sovereignty is. Like, big sort of capital K keywords that, like, that are, like, whole sections of libraries, right? That we just fold into something called imperialism, colonization, whatever, right? Like, shorthand, right? Like, India under the British. Just, like, useful things that, like, make it easier to talk about. However, like, I totally agree with you that, like, Indians and South Asians were ruled by a corporation which had guns and men under its control, which could then sort of enforce rules that actively hurt that population and, like, required them to participate in. Like, that also is the situation now. It's just,
yes.
It's just evolved differently. It's just, like, it's just changed now. The parameters have changed. That the nature of the exploitation has changed, like, or not the nature of it.
But barely, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, not the nature necessarily, but, like, with the look of it, the feel of it, how we relate to it, how we talk about it. Sure, that stuff has changed, but it's still one of, like, subordination to capital. So, like, how can you, like, I think there's a radical sort of distance that you create when you, like, when you periodize things and you're like, oh, seven, like, you know, India under the British, that's like 19th century, that's far away. But it's like, no, like the same corporations are also still around. Like, Hudson's Bay was a thing then and it's a thing now.
I mean, oh my God, yeah. Iconic Canadian blanket. Yes. I can't tell you how much research I've done on the iconic Canadian blanket. It turns out it was not used as a tool of smallpox spreading, by the way.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, and these are things that are like cheap signifiers of like of regular normal life in Canada. So like this year, it's hard to, as corny as this sounds, as if I'm the first person to say this, but like, it's hard to imagine the world without reverting to the language that imperialists themselves cemented or like minted and in the pursuance of that empire, right? So you call it a mutiny to put them down. Like, you can't, it's impossible to imagine it, right? Like, well, it would be like, you can't unclear a forest, right? Like, you can't just, you can't get those trees back. Like, they're burnt or their desks, you know, like.
And and you can replant it, but the soil has been changed, et cetera. Like, oh my God. So I have so many, this is just a really exciting train of thought for me because it like also feels very much in my like poetry life. But, I mean, I think it gets back to the question you were asking earlier about like epidemiology as a specific discipline. Like there are terms that kind of function loosely, but there's also a kind of, you see more, I think, when you historicize them. So like, I really admired the work of a early Americanist, a professor who was teaching in the Columbia, English department when I was there, called Cristobal Silva, and he wrote a book called Miraculous Plagues about immune contact in early America, and he wrote about epidemiology in a way like kind of before it was formalized, and it's incredible work. Like, it's a beautiful book. There's also, I think, something that happens when a society is created, and that happened only in 1850. So like, they're historicizing these terms. Like, yes, epidemic has like many historical meanings, but what does it mean in this moment? I think also tells us something about disciplines. It tells us something about knowledge production. I mean, even to go back to your example of Islam in quotes, like the concept of religion is also in some senses a colonial construct. Like the demand that you pick, are you monotheistic or polytheistic? Like, are you Hindu or Muslim? Like, as And are you like, what is a Shia, for example? Like, these practices are so intertwined everywhere in lived life. So I basically take for granted that all of these constructs are colonial ones, because these vehicular languages were violently imposed, in some cases at the threat of corporal punishment, on us and our ancestors. And so, like, to work with those terms is to kind of be with Césaire in discourse on colonialism, and to say, like, we can't imagine romantically a past without colonial contact. We can't return there. As you say, like, you can't burn down the forest or undeforest a forest. So the project is to sort of, like, find power where it is and then, like, trace it out to where we are now. I don't know if that sounds too, like...
Yeah, I actually want you to, based on what you just said, could you read the final, like, final half page of page 25, like the closing of your introduction? Because I think that, because it kind of explains what you just said, but in different
starting. See, I gotta...
Tonal shift. Just the whole last page. It's great stuff.
Oh, thank you so much. Okay, yeah. What began under the Bush administration?
Yeah, like, start with tonal shift. Because that's kind of... Because this is also tonal shift in British imperial... Anyways.
Yeah. So for anybody who's following along at home, this is page 24 to 25 of the introduction. A tonal shift can be observed in the nature of these stories in parallel with the political moments they reflect. What began under the Bush administration as an emotional nationalist incarnation of the master narrative of East-West incommensurability and conflict gave way during the Obama years to a more rhetorically tempered approach to preventing terrorism and eradicating the spread of its ideologies through domestic and international surveillance, a suite of new intelligence programs in collaboration with large, heavily armed urban police forces, and ongoing ground war assassinations and surgical strikes against Al-Qaeda and ISIS targets and others. We find ourselves now in a full-blooded resurgence of an earlier incarnation of American xenophobia and pandemic anxiety, this time attached to the rise of so-called populism, white supremacy, neo-Nazism, neo-fascism, state-sanctioned misogyny, anti-Black and anti-Latinx hatred, immigration criminalization, and concentration camps on our borders. If recent observations hold, the literature, television, and film history of the Trump moment is likely to follow the dystopian lead of fictions chronicling life under neo-fascism, pumped up by the near total emergency of the COVID-19 pandemic. I've written this book to reckon with the history I've been living as an American Muslim since the morning of September 11th in New York. The violent, indefensible response of the country I was born and raised in shaped the course of my career and research. I close this chapter of my life spent on this project just as we begin to reckon with the distant and proximate effects of an unprecedented worldwide health emergency. I hope, therefore, that this book will inspire further research and provide a solid foundation for those who undertake it. Actually, just in, like, circling back to something you said earlier about the coincidence and non-coincidence of the fact that we've, like, had very similar research trajectories, I think in a way, like, the sentence at the end of my introduction is like, I hope too that, like, you know, six kids around the country in the next generation of scholars, like, read that sentence and were like, okay, now what do I do? And, like, their projects will have a family resemblance, right?
Yeah, no, I agree. And, but it's more, I wanted to talk to you about, like, the experience of growing up in the U.S. because I didn't grow up in the U.S. It was it's different. Like, the terrorism discourse was very similar. Like, we picked up a lot of it, but it definitely wasn't Bush's America. So, like, you were one of the disease subjects in this country. And on top of that, you grew up in New York State, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was a kid. So actually one interesting thing to say is that I was a kid in Albany, and then my family moved to Dover, Delaware, which has the second largest Air Force base in the country, in, I think, 91. So, as you can imagine, everybody in school with us had, like, someone in the family who was, like, in the Gulf War. It was the first time in my life that, like, a large group of my classmates or the people around us were, like, calling us racial slurs. Everybody thought we were Arab. Eventually we left because my mom was, who's Pakistani, was being so, like, just disrespected on the basis of her race and her perceived Arabness and her Muslimness, that it, you know, I mean, the slurs reached a point where, like, it was like happening in professional contexts. So my parents were like, we have to go somewhere good. And then, you know, I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts for my teenage years. I mean, in a way, did you grow up in Toronto proper or like?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, like, yeah.
GTA. Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there just like weren't a lot of other Muslim kids anywhere in my childhood. So it was, to an extent in Cambridge, there were a lot of Asians because of the universities and like a ton of people who were there on like postdocs or research appointments or whatever. But it was a pretty like unknown quantity to the worlds that I lived in. Until September 11th. And then everybody certainly had an opinion about like what it meant that my family was Shia versus not, and what it meant that, you know, so suddenly that was like an identity that was very much, I don't know, like in the air. The Dover thing was kind of an exception, but that was like, I don't know, it was just really interestingly linked to like class and race in America and like who is in the armed forces. And then the Bush years were a nightmare. I mean, not for me personally, although like certainly there were a ton of hate crimes and attacks in New York City, especially, I don't know if you remember this, but like especially on Sikh cab drivers who were like perceived to be Muslim. I don't know. I don't think my experience.
Yeah, like there was a Sikh temple that was burned down in Hamilton.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And no, actually,
the scale of the rage, like the racial rage, like I wonder, because I regret to inform everybody who's listening to this who doesn't know this already, but we are hitting 20 years of 9/11 this September, folks.
Yeah.
So everybody get your brain pills out, your brain damage pills, whatever you like, whatever you prefer for brain damage, fun times. Load up on those. Just take all of those beginning around September 6th, September 7th. Just load up on those and then ride out for like the next 2 weeks because we will be inundated with
20th anniversary specials.
Think about the like nostalgia is a thing, right? Like nostalgia is very real, very palpable right now. Like it's not a good time to live in the contemporary. People love to live in the past, right? And like a huge aspect of like the culture industry is like this disease of nostalgia. And like the clips of 9/11 will be in our face. Like all the interviews, the survivors, people who lost loved ones, we are going to be, and it's going to be done over Zoom. It's going to make it worse. Like
there's going to be so many waving flags.
Yes. And there's going to be a lot of who was Bin Laden, what happened in Afghanistan. I mean, not really, probably not. Definitely Bin Laden, but like the level of like forgetting that it takes to not remember the absolutely psychotic racist backlash against any brown people of any kind. And like that to me is like, I mean, I'm going to have to do an episode about it, and you should actually
yeah,
come
we should
on.
Do it. We should do it because, together. Cause that would be really, yeah. I mean, it would be, I think it's going to be an incredible week for discourse analysis. And already, as you were saying, like, I don't know if you remember this part, but I was really like, as I was writing the preface, it was March of 2020, as I was writing the preface, so I was like watching Zaddy Cuomo on the news conference every day. And he was like,
did you just call him Zaddy Cuomo?
I mean, I do not stand, but I did watch the press conferences. He like, you know, he in those first days, he was like, this is exactly like 9/11. And that nostalgia was like printed all the fuck over the COVID-19 panic, and it's coming back. It's going to be our lost loved ones. I mean, I don't know if you've seen this book or read any of it, but there's a gorgeous collection of essays by Carla Cornejo Villavicencio called The Undocumented Americans. And her chapter on September 11th on Ground Zero is like, it's the only form of memorialization I feel like I can tolerate. Like it's a beautiful eulogy for the many, many Latinx and undocumented workers who also died on 9/11, who were like delivering breakfasts to like shithead, coked out bankers at 8 a.m. I mean, there are stories we haven't told about that day that are tragic and important and like tell us a lot about who we are as a country and how fucked up we are as a country. And I think you're right. I think we're not going to hear those stories. In 2021, but or in, on September 11, 2021. So you and I should talk about it. And maybe we can call Carla because she's a genius and it would be cool to talk
about. You should host it. No, you're the New Yorker. You, like, I think the New Yorkers have to, like, take over that day, because a lot of, like, the identity of, like, American cities or, like, New York cities, and, like, it gave us, like, Global Giuliani. It gave us, like, it gave us, like, FDNY.
Global NYPD. Act. Yeah.
And, yeah, like, all that stuff. But now, 20 years later, like, this summer, we had all kinds of, like, uprisings and our own, you know, I don't want to say mutiny, but, like, our own kind of mini rebellions regarding, like, those police forces that are so much lauded, that were, like, just injected with steroids since 9/11 in the name of 9/11.
Literally, like, armed with the fucking gear that was bought for the war on terror.
Yeah, like, we say tanked out in German, in English, but in German they say ausgepanzert, like, you're panzered out. And, like, that's why every time when I see, like, a New York City cop when I was there for, like, a few months, like, I was like, oh my God, they really do look like that, because they're also kind of, like, schlubby too, because, like, New York's kind of a schlubby city. Like, the tri-state area is kind of, I mean, this is coming from somebody who was in, like, Los Angeles for a long time, like, West Side Los Angeles.
It.
I'm like, so, like, New Yorkers are, like, schlubby about it. Like, they also don't care. Like, it's not. And so their cops look funny with, like, their huge, like, Meiji era, like, chainmail. That's, like,
and their tiny,
like,
little heart coffee, and their, like, dainty little Danish.
Yeah. And they're drinking out of, like, the New York coffee mugs, like, the ones with, like, the faux Greek. And it's like, I can't believe this is the city that, like, I had to hear about nonstop for 2 years, like, mythologized, like Woody Allen and his thing at the Oscars. And it's like, so much of, like, what we consumed growing up, like, especially before the internet, because we didn't have fucking choice. And, like, so much of it, what we consumed growing up, was, like, these hyper nationalist bullshit that, like, was the exact equivalent of the 1857 stuff of, like, the mutiny nostalgia. So, like, I mean, we're
oh my God, 45 minutes.
We haven't even talked about Kipling yet, but, like, Kipling and like the experience of the mutiny, this guy, like, cashed in big time.
Yeah. Like, not just him. I mean, young. He is the one that we remember. I mean, I think it's also worth saying, like, there are all of those novels that we don't remember, the Phillips Meadows Taylor and the, you know, it's like these Robert Armitage Sterndale, like these crummy best-selling, huge triple-decker Victorian novels. Like, it's exactly the same as DeLillo's bullshit 9/11 novel and John Updike's bullshit 9/11 novel. You know what I mean? It was like, well, if you're a writer, you got to write about this. The mutiny was exactly
like this was their moment of victimization.
Totally.
Like, oh, we're the victims now.
Yep. And, like, arrogating to some sense of an eyewitness account as if it was the telling of history. Like, the presumed subject position of total omniscience. Like, if I'm a white dude and I live in New York, like, I know what happened on 9/11 and I'm going to tell you about it. And I'm going to, like, I'm doing my responsibility to history by recording it. It's like, no, shut the fuck up.
Yeah. Yeah. So wait, but you know, I realize we haven't actually explained what the mutiny was. There is, I do have an episode. Well, not me, actually. Justin Poder has an episode on his podcast called, what's it called? The Empire Podcast, Anti-Empire Project. And it's also on my feed, the first chunk of it. So look it up. He does a kind of civilization score. So people who are curious about that, he kind of explains it. Because also there was, like, a murderous, like, genocidal, like, actual military reaction to it too. It wasn't just the historical thing. Like, the same way that the U.S., like, just straight up murdered a bunch of people, a lot of people in Afghanistan, in the name of revenge, like, the Brits did that in the aftermath of 1857.
Oh, absolutely. And I will add, I don't
10
know
million is a number I've heard.
Oh my God, that's beyond numbers I've heard, but it certainly was an outrageous and vengeful bloodbath. I mean, it depends, I suppose, how long you count the aftermath. Like, if you count it to 1920 and, like, Jallianwala Bagh, then definitely I would say it was in the millions. But I don't know. I think in case Justin didn't mention this, and I'm excited to listen to that episode too. It was also, like, really in defense of white women. Like, all of that murder that happened after the mutiny was, like, super, super gendered. And it was super white men protecting white women from rapacious, ravenous, libidinal, like, fanatic, crazed Muslim men. So that mythology, like you see it, especially in the visual archive of the mutiny, like the paintings, you always have this, like, you may remember some of these images from the book, but like frail damsels in distress, white women being saved by like Highland guards or other colonial soldiers from their brown captors. So that mythology, you know, it's very much in play in the war in Afghanistan. Now post 9/11, it's like the Muslim women who need saving, but it's pretty much the same narrative.
Right. And like the nature of that vengeance was celebrated too, right? Like there are tons of illustrations. Like one of the things they did, like famously, was shoot like cannonballs through people's chests. They would tie insurgents to like cannons and just shoot cannonballs through their chests. And like, this was like a sadistic, like we really let the Brits off for their violence. Like,
oh, yeah,
we really do.
They're so cute with their tea.
Yeah, like it really is. It's like it's tea and crumpets. It's fucking Buckingham guards, Buckingham Palace guards. It's fucking Agatha Christie. But the reality is, for tens of millions, possibly hundreds of millions, but like this was a genocidal, murderous like empire that lasted centuries.
Yeah, and like, it didn't start in 1857 either.
And it didn't start in 1857. And that terraformed the planet and like scarred, like, human civilization history, like the scarring of the earth, like by these people, is like unfathomable. And so it's so interesting that, and part of the sort of main goal of your book is to sort of say, like, look how they channel their thinking about this crazy thing that they do called imperialism and the responses to it, the very human organic responses to it, which is to try to throw it off, and look how they pathologize it and turn it into a disease. And then make careers fighting it, studying it, talking about it. And that's fucking 9/11, man.
And pretending that they're the ones who are healing it. You guys are so sick. We have to come take care of you.
Like CNN, a country, like a media service that has the resources to platform anyone in the world, chooses to platform these like dime a dozen idiots that are like self-defined terrorism experts. And it's just because like the producers like them. And I know this because I'm a producer. I know what it's like to make content. You're like, hey, call that asshole. Is he available? Boom. Get him on the air. Like, you don't care. You don't care what goes on. It's like sausage. You just fucking send it out, whatever. Right. So like the fact that like there's no serious conversation and like terrorism becomes this catch-all phrase. So yeah, I mean, maybe, okay, we're about to hit an hour. So maybe we should shift to the closing. I mean, we're gonna have to skip Algeria, but like let's talk to the close of the book. So you made this kind of interesting decision to close the book, and you know, a lot of sort of literary studies books are built around this architecture of close reading individual texts, right? Or like a set of texts and then situating them in a larger archive. And this is like a, you know, this is decades old process or whatever, like conventions of our field. And so, but one of the things that you chose is that you sort of, and I did this too with the choice in my books, but mine was still ostensibly a kind of literary thing. I mean, yours is too, but just different in terms of like how they're sold on bookshelves, right? Because the 9/11 report isn't exactly sold on like the light reading shelf, right? Like it's not sold on like the fiction. It's like this, it's a government document, right? But it was written for publication in a sense. Like it wasn't like it was, and like, I mean, I have it and stuff. But obviously I haven't read it as closely as you have. But like, why, what gravitated you towards this text? Like did people give you shit for this decision? They were like, what? You're going to do what with your final chapter of your book?
Totally. Well, I mean, I think people, I have to say, everybody I talked to about it when I was putting this chapter together was like, wow, like you must not be sleeping much. And especially with the Senate report on torture as well. But it's interesting. Like it really came from reading a bunch of reviews right when it came out, because it was published by Norton at a $10 price point, which is very cheap for a big paperback like that. And it was published, I think, simultaneously with the online release. So they wanted it to sell. Like they were like, we're trying to make a bestseller. And somebody or other, one of these men that I cited earlier, who I am not particularly fond of, said that it was the most important group written text since the King James Bible.
Shut up.
Yep.
Shut up. Oh, I hate when people say that shit.
Yeah.
Oh, the book that's important to me is important to the world.
But also, like, how dare you, like, drag the King James Bible by comparing it to this trash? But it's also a beautiful Bible. And somebody else was like, it reads like a novel. Like, people were writing about it like it was a thriller. And so, you know, it was honestly, like, I don't think this would be hard for better critics, but for me, it was really hard. Like, making sense of that document was really hard. And I think the key for me came in figuring out that Ernest May, who was a historian of American empire at Harvard for years and years and years, was basically the architect of this book as a book. He wasn't, you know, the primary commissioner. He wasn't in charge of all of the research, but he really was in charge of shaping the narrative. And to have somebody who spent their entire career studying American imperialism, like, I mean, he has books on the war in the Philippines. He has books on the kind of like debates on American imperialism in the late 19th century. He really, it's his hand that I think is the heaviest in this book. And so once I kind of figured that out, I was like, okay, now I think I understand how to read it as both a synoptic text, by which I mean like co-authored in the way that early epidemiology is co-authored. Like, it's always like multiple witnesses and like different points of view. And part of that like landscape level view has that form to it, that kind of documentary multiple voices form. But May, I think, really shaped the beginnings and the endings of the chapters, which is where a lot of the narrative intensity comes, the kind of mood, the tone. I mean, it's an incredibly technical document, but it's also very readable in a way. So I did, you know, once I kind of figured out that there was a like literary making process, it became much easier to convince people that I was, you know, like giving talks to, or like when I didn't actually wind up finishing that chapter for the disc. So it was a new chapter, in the book. I had always planned to do it, but I just kind of, I was like, here's what I can say about it in the introduction, but it didn't have its own chapter until this book stage. But yeah, it was incredibly hard and incredibly fun. And I think also just, it speaks to this culture industry thing we've been talking about 9/11, because they did publish, like FSG published almost simultaneously a graphic novel version of it, which is sort of mind blowing. Like, it's a really
goddamn
difficult and violent text. I know.
Fuck off.
And they were like, oh yeah, like, let's make a version for kids. Like,
oh, that's it.
Which is crazy.
I gotta go. I'll see. This was fun.
You gotta look at it. I mean, like, I'll send you photos of some of the pages. Like, it's wild. Like, why did they think this was a good idea? Also, like, why not? Like, sure, there should be a graphic, but like, shouldn't there also be a graphic novel version of the Senate Intelligence Committee report on torture then? Or like, I don't know. So putting those two things next to each other was really helpful in terms of shaping that final chapter. But I think I became super interested in what Ernest May himself called state-sponsored prose. And I was like, if a literary critic can't do something interesting with this, then like, we're all fucked. Like somebody has to read this thing and read it properly and put it in context and think about what it's up to narratively. So that's what I was trying to do in the last chapter. And I really, really hope it's useful to others, because nobody wants to wade through all the pages of that report.
Yeah. I mean, it's also like, you know, there's a problem with like so much of what's left of 9/11 is just the hollow hyper-nationalist memorialization of it. I mean, motherfuckers called it Ground Zero. Like, Ground Zero is a term for where the nuclear bomb goes off, okay? Like, and who has caused the only Ground Zero in the world? Like, the U.S. Like, that like metaphor, and it's so like perverse, like appropriation of like, you know, W.J. Zabel has this term, the natural history of destruction. Mm-hmm. And the sort of bombing of he has this great essay on this bombing of German cities and how and he's speaking as a kind of someone who grew up in what became known as West Germany, the Federal Republic, whatever. And like how this was erased from memory because so many cities were just rebuilt. And obviously with the help of all those sort of big corporations that moved in to clean up and whatever, Marshall Fund. And like, and it just kind of erased erase all that violence, erase all that history, right? Like, get the rubble out of the way. And so it's interesting that, like, the memory of 9/11 turned into the absurd, megalomaniacal, like, capitalist kind of wet dream project of just another stupid skyscraper that, like, is 1,776 feet tall.
I hate that thing.
Like this is, and like there were like mini dramas around it too. Like, forget the actual building. Like, there's actually I don't know why.
Fire.
Yeah. Like, well, there's like a book about this called 16 Acres, and it's about the kind. I don't know why I remember this. I read this book like 2006. It's like in my brain for some reason. I haven't nuked it from my brain, but like.
You
ground zeroed
it out.
Yeah, get out of here. I don't need this book in my memory. But like, I remember thinking, like, what a farce. Like anything in New York turns into a farce when it's like valuable land we're talking about. And this was just another thing, right? And so like, compare that to, you know, the very real victims, like the very real history of pain and suffering that was written on that day in New York, like the lives that were erased from the earth, like a lot of, as you said, some of whom like we didn't, that never got mentioned, like probably got forgotten. Some of them were undocumented, right? So how much of New York like officially exists? Like, somebody has to call them in, right? So like that kind of memorialization that went on forever, that probably we're going to get another dose of, but like that was just superstructure. Like the real base was like this multi-billion dollar project going on. And it was just like, oh, typical American thing. Like, you turn something into like a business, like you could make a buck off of it. Yeah. And that was like ground zero. And then like in addition to the drama
and the whole industry around tourism,
like a 9/11 victims memorial became a whole thing. Like, it became like it was just turned into like, it was like they just mined it for more wealth,
which is also really difficult for New Yorkers. Like, I will say to your earlier question about like being Muslim in America, and I mean, there is also the violence of like having the nation's nostalgic chauvinism like thrust upon your city. Like, I mean, I realize that there were a lot of New Yorkers who were complicit in the creation of that Leapskin Tower, but like, it's also now a place where I don't feel like I can go. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a place in New York City where tourists who are oftentimes like crypto white nationalists, or like people who really, you know, for whom the symbolism of 9/11 is, as you say, like the symbolism of the worst thing since Pearl Harbor, or the worst thing in American history. Like, I feel therefore unwelcome in my own city in that place now. It's like a scary place to be. And not because I'm scared of terrorists, because I'm scared of being called a terrorist and existing in my home city, in that space that is now for like America, not for New Yorkers. It's twisted. It's like part of that weird memorial is like part of the archipelago of a middle America that like doesn't care about New Yorkers in some pretty profound way, even though I think the memorial is quite beautiful, like as a piece of art.
Well, what's interesting too is that New York City has this weird thing in America you have like a sane amount of power invested in states' legislatures, and so, and correct me if I'm wrong, but like Albany, which is the capital of New York, hates New York City, right? And like famously underfunds things, and like that's why like the subway looks like it's been bombed out.
Yeah.
Like, that's why like New York's infrastructure is so decrepit. Like, it's that it's its own victim. It's a victim of its own like dislikeness at like the state level. So like, what is this New York state? Like, unfortunately, I know way too much about New York as like a state. I really don't want to know this stuff. Like,
well, you border really us, so you have to.
Yeah, I know. Well, I grew up watching like commercial, like the broadcasters and stuff. They were Western New York broadcasters. So like, all the names of like North Tonawanda, Cheektowaga. Like, I know all these weird
my
little.
My dad is from Cheektowaga. I love it.
Which is like, you know, like that's like how we imagine like America, like from the Canadian angle, is like a whole different conversation. But okay, we've gone over an hour. I'm going to ask you one final question, then I'll let you go. Okay. So the cover. Tell me about the cover of this book.
Oh my God. I was so glad that you like it. So oh man. First of all, just My editor, Alan Thomas, is an angel on earth, and he has been incredible every step of the way and just like so supportive. And especially for a first-time author, he's been amazing. The only little like semi-tense conversation we ever had was when he sent me the cover mock-up, and I was like, this looks like it was written by like six men. Like, I'm a very femme person, and this looks like a Tom Clancy book. Like, I cannot, Alan. Like, no. And he was like, he basically was like, this is not up for discussion. I mean, I chose the historical image, and it was, it's a really interesting, in fact, I'll just like tweet it to you. And so anybody who's listening to this episode can like look at the image itself, but the title of the image is "The Kind of Assisted Emigrant We Can't Afford to Admit." And it's an 1882 cartoon by Friedrich Gratz, and it was published in Puck. And it's this figure in a fez and a shalvar, basically, I think, with a belt that says cholera on it, and who is a skeleton, is riding on the prow of this ship into the New York Harbor. And there's like all these health commissioners and police officers like shooting big bottles of like carbolic acid at him. And it's such an amazing condensation in the late 19th century of like exactly the immigration, xenophobia, Muslim ban stuff. Like, it's New York City. Like, it's literally down in the Battery. It's right near where the World Trade Center was. Really incredible resonances with like all the stories I'm trying to tell in the book and how persistent this metaphor, this imagery is. And yeah, so the cover came to me with that historical image, but used in a way that struck me as like just really different from what I was imagining. I was like, it's so red. The font is so sans serif. Like, it just looks like it was written by a boy. But Alan, to his credit, was like, trust me, this really isn't a discussion. And I was like, okay, I guess it's not a discussion, but everybody loves it. And I think it's memorable, and I love it now too. And my girlfriend, who's a designer, absolutely adores it. So I trust her on this more than I trust myself. And it is absolutely not how I imagined my book looking, but I actually feel quite proud to have written a book that looks like it's about like serious things and was written by a dude.
Yeah. That's good. That's good. Congratulations. Congratulations.
Thank you.
This was a lot of fun. Thank you, Anjali. I'm so glad. I'm so glad we got to chat. We should have met a long time ago, somehow in conferences or something. I was a very bad citizen of the field, let me tell you. Like, I was not. I hated going to conferences. I kind of hated the field. I don't even like literature anymore.
More reason why we should have met, because I was like sulking in the lobby being like, I don't want to go to panels.
Yeah, that's true. But the book is out now?
It's like in the mail. So official pub date is February, but I should have it in my hands either later tonight or early tomorrow morning.
Epidemic Empire, Colonialism, Contagion, and Terror, 1817 to 2020. Anjali, how do we find you?
Oh, I'm on Twitter at Anjali Fatima, AnjuliFatima. And my website is AnjaliRezaKolb.com, and all my work is there. And find me anywhere. You can Google me. I have a very Googleable name. And anybody who's listening who wants to talk more or email or whatever, chat, I am so happy to do that. Visit classes, whatever. Just talk to you about your research or other topics, because, you know, I have other interests other than epidemics and terrorism, thankfully.
Well, those are the best interests of them all. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This has been really, really fun. And I hope that this is the beginning of us talking actually kind of regularly about stuff.
Yes.